attend a work holiday party. They leave their 6-month-old daughter with her grandmother. At the party, they don ski masks and fire 75 rounds from 2 variant AR-15 rifles. 14 co-workers are killed, and 21 seriously injured. The assailants die in a shootout with police 4 hours later. The FBI obtains shooter Syed Rizwan Farooq's iPhone 5C and requests, and receives, a federal court order mandating Apple to create and provide software to unlock the phone. Apple defies the order. Over the next week, I was on Bloomberg TV twice to discuss the issue, and a strange thing happened. I started getting hate mail regarding my view that Apple should comply with the court order. A lot of hate mail. Wherever you stand in the debate regarding Apple and privacy, the more interesting question is, would we have endured this hand-wringing if the shooter's phone had been a BlackBerry? No. Why? Because the FBI-inspired court order to unlock the phone would have had a different reception at the door of the Waterloo, Canada headquarters. My guess is that if the Canadian firm didn't unlock the phone within 48 hours, several dozen congressmen and congresswomen would threaten a trade embargo. Pew surveyed the U.S. public on the issue and found it mostly split. However, there was a huge skew between cohorts. In sum, young Democrats were on Apple's side and old Republicans government. That wasn't what you might expect from either side, the former being for expanding the power of big government, and the latter protecting the prerogatives of big business. But Apple and the other horsemen play by a different set of rules. Put another way, anybody who matters in the consumer world is for Apple. Young Democrats, millennials with college degrees, didn't just inherit the earth, they conquered it, led by engineering grads from MIT and Harvard dropouts. They are growing their income, spending it irrationally, as young people do, and have a facility with technology that makes them influential and important to business. They sided with Apple, as the firm embodies their own maverick anti-establishment progressive ideals, and conveniently ignored the fact that Steve Jobs gave nothing to charity, almost exclusively hired middle-aged white guys, and was an awful person. It didn't matter, because Apple is cool. Even more, Apple is an innovator. And so, when the federal government decides to force Apple to change its behavior, the Apple Macolites leap to its defense. I'm not one of them. Double standard. I've always tried to give the impression that I just don't care what others think. But when coworkers, many of whom are millennials with Ivy League degrees, sent me polite hate mail, which hurts more than just plain hateful hope you die hate mail, it rattled me. The source of their disappointment was my views on the Apple privacy issue. More specifically, that I wasn't on the correct side of the Apple privacy issue. They felt I wasn't protecting personal privacy. What they failed to see, I believe, is they were not so much on the side of privacy as on the side of Apple. Their and Apple's arguments. Apple, by creating a new iOS that allowed the FBI to open the phone with brute force, would create a backdoor that could not be contained and could end up in the wrong hands. Spectre? And the government cannot conscript firms into surveillance upon private citizens. My response to the first claim. If Apple was creating a back door for others to use, it was a pretty unimpressive door. More like a doggy door. Apple estimated that it would take 6 to 10 engineers a month to figure this out. That ain't the Manhattan Project. Apple also maintained this key could end up in the wrong hands and prove hugely dangerous. We aren't talking about the microchip that gave rise to the Terminator, which travels back in time to destroy all humanity. And the FBI even agreed to let the work take place on the Apple campus, ensuring it didn't become an app we can download from www.fbi.gov. Again, These aren't G-men with itchy trigger fingers lurking in doorways and alleys outside the Biograph Theater. Their second argument, that a commercial firm shouldn't be enlisted in government fights against its will, is a marginally better one. However, does this mean if Ford Motor can construct a car trunk the FBI can't unlock, where it believes there is a kidnap victim suffocating, then the Bureau can't ask Ford to help them get in? Judges issue search warrants every day. They comply with search and seizure laws that prevent indiscriminate searches, and order homes, cars, and computers searched for evidence or information that might prevent or solve a crime. Yet somehow, we've decided the iPhone is sacred. It isn't obliged to follow the same rules as the rest of the business world. The sacred and the profane. Objects are often considered holy or sacred if they are used for spiritual purposes, such as the worship of gods. Steve Jobs became the innovation economy's Jesus, and his shining achievement, the iPhone, became the conduit for his worship, elevated above other material items or technologies. We have thus, in essence, fetishized the iPhone, and in the process, opened the door to a new kind of corporate extremism to emerge. While this extremism doesn't put us in actual physical danger, I don't believe employees of Apple are violent radicals, this kind of secular worship is dangerous. Why? Because when we allow an enterprise to run unchecked and lawless, we've lost respect for the proper standards they versus other firms get to play by. The resulting two-tiered system creates a winner-take-all environment that adds further fuel to the flames of inequality. Simply put, the Steve Jobs-era Apple got away with behavior, not least Jobs' own actions regarding backdated stock options awarded to him by Apple, that no other U.S. company CEO would have gotten away with. At some point, the American people and the U.S. government decided that Jobs and Apple were no longer constrained by law. Things remained that way until Mr. Jobs' death. Was it worth it? You decide. In the first decade of the 21st century, following Jobs' return to Apple, the company embarked on the greatest run of innovation in business history. In those 10 years, Apple introduced one earth-shaking $100 billion category-creating new product or service after another. The iPod, iTunes and Apple Store, iPhone and iPad, there has never been anything like it. During those years, the consumer electronics industry was a chocolate factory and Steve Jobs its Willy Wonka. Every winter at the annual Worldwide Developers Conference, Jobs would stand on stage and announce one new product upgrade after another, then start to exit the stage, stop, turn, and say, "Oh, and one more thing," and change the world. Suddenly, what had been a comparatively minor customer convention became an agora. The world's stock markets held their collective breaths. News reporters gathered outside Moscone Center at dawn, previewing the next few hours. And Apple's competitors sat watching news feeds, hearts in throats, in terror of what would hit them next. It's easy to forget now just how stunning Apple's decade was. The iPod's introduction in late 2001, after the twin shocks of the bursting of the dot-com bubble and 9/11, played the same role as the Beatles' appearance on Ed Sullivan just months after the Kennedy assassination. It was a bright light in the darkness that signaled hope and optimism. Then, Jobs used his Hollywood muscle to force an overreaction that, of course, rewarded Apple on the audio download piracy started by Napster that threatened to destroy the music industry. That set the stage for the masterpiece, the iPhone, that had Apple fanatics all over the world camping out in front of electronics stores. And finally, the sublime iPad. The unsung hero of Apple's success is Napster founder Sean Fanning, who scared the music industry into the arms of Apple, and who set about partnering with them similar to the way a vampire partners with a blood bag. Could Apple have maintained this pace into the current decade had Steve Jobs survived his illness? Probably. Because for all of his less-than-savory traits, he accomplished one important thing. He turned Apple, after the risk-averse years under John Sculley, into a company, arguably the biggest company ever, that made taking risks its first option. Unlike every other Fortune 500 CEO, Steve Jobs punished careful thinking, and history recorded the results. Steve Jobs, not Bob Noyce at Intel or David Packard at HP, became the first person to found a company and then make it the most valuable company in the world. Stores, touchscreens, and a reheated MP3 player all at the time made no sense. For all the good that Jobs did for Apple, he was also a destructive force inside the company. He bullied employees. His attitudes around philanthropy and inclusiveness were small. His mercurial personality and megalomania kept Apple perpetually in borderline chaos. His death ended the company's historic run of innovation. But it also let Apple, under Tim Cook, focus on predictability, profitability, and scale. You can see the results on the balance sheet. If profits are a sign of success, in fiscal year 2015, Apple was the most successful firm in history, registering $53.4 billion net profit. If Apple were anything but a Fortune 500 tech darling, Congress would have implemented tax reforms. But most politicians, like other privileged classes around the world, feel a tiny rush when they pull out their iPhones. It's no contest. Apple versus, say, Exxon is likable. Come on, think different. Closer to God. Apple has always found inspiration from others. Latin for stealing ideas. The sector that has inspired Apple's modern-day strategy is the luxury industry. Apple decided to pursue scarcity to achieve outsized, irrational profits that are nearly impossible for new money, gauche tech hardware brands to imitate. The Cupertino firm controls 14.5% of the smartphone market, but captures 79% of global smartphone profits, 2016. Steve Jobs instinctively understood this. Attendees at the 1977 Western Computer Conference in San Francisco registered the difference the instant they walked into Brooks Hall. While all other new personal computer companies were offering stripped-out motherboards or ugly metal boxes, Jobs and Woz sat at their table behind the 10 injected plastic Apple II computers that would define the elegant Apple look. The Apple computers were beautiful. They were elegant. Most of all, in a world of hackers and gearheads, Apple's products bespoke luxury. Luxury is not an externality. It's in our genes. It combines our instinctive need to transcend the human condition and feel closer to divine perfection, with our desire to be more attractive to potential mates. For millennia, we've knelt in churches, mosques, and temples, looked around and thought, there is no way human hands could have created Reims, Hagia Sophia, Pantheon, and Karnak. No way mere humans could have created this alchemy of sound, art, and architecture without divine inspiration. Listen to how transcendent the music is. That statue, those frescoes, these marble walls. I'm taken out of the ordinary world. This must be where God lives. Historically, the masses haven't had access to luxury, so they journeyed to churches and saw chalices encrusted in jewels, gleaming chandeliers, the most beautiful art in the world. They started to associate the combined aesthetic overwhelm from superior artisanship with the presence of God. This is the cornerstone of luxury. Thanks to the Industrial Revolution and the rise of general prosperity, that luxury in the 20th century came within reach of hundreds of millions, even billions, of people. In the 18th century, the French aristocracy spent 3% of the nation's GDP on beautiful wigs, powders, and dresses. They relied on the opulence of their dress to convey status and inspire respect and submission in their servants. Nike invented neither theater retailing nor endorsements. The Catholic Church has known for centuries the power of an edifice, stores, and built a brand that has survived in the face of wars and astounding scandals. Marie Antoinette's powdered makeup, wigs, and dresses became the rage. Now LeBron wears Beats. Nothing has changed. Why? Natural selection, and the desire and envy that arise from it. Powerful people have greater access to housing, warmth, food, and sexual partners. Many who surround themselves with beautiful things claim they are not pursuing a mate, but pure appreciation for the objects. Sort of. The mesh on a Bottega Veneta bag or the slope on the back of a Porsche 911 puts you in the moment. Just so beautiful. You want to possess it, stand in the light of its power, and register how people view you in this softest, most flattering light. Drive a Porsche, even at 55 miles an hour, and you feel more attractive, and more likely to have a random sexual experience. Since men are wired to procreate aggressively, the caveman in us hungers for that Rolex or Lamborghini, or Apple. And the caveman, thinking with his genitals, will sacrifice a lot, pay an irrational price, for the chance to impress. Luxury products make no sense on a rational level. We just can't break free of the desire to be closer to divine perfection or to procreate. When luxury works, the act of spending itself is part of the experience. Buying a diamond necklace out of the back of a truck, even if the stones are real, isn't as satisfying as the purchase at Tiffany. From a well-dressed sales assistant who presents the necklace under brilliant lights and speaks in hushed tones. Luxury is the market equivalent of feathers on a bird. It's irrational and sexual, and it easily overwhelms the killjoy rational signals of the brain, such as, you can't afford this, or this really makes no sense. Luxury has also generated enormous wealth. The collision of God and sex atoms ignited energy and value never before seen in business. The list of the 400 wealthiest people on the planet, minus inherited wealth and finance, includes more people from luxury and retail than technology or any other industry sector. Here's a list of the source of wealth for the 10 richest people in Europe. Who cares who they are? Their companies are infinitely more interesting than they are. Zara, L'Oreal, H&M, LVMH, Nutella, Aldi, Lidl, Trader Joe's, Luxottica, Crate & Barrel. The luxury of time. No technology firm has solved the problem of aging, losing relevance. As a luxury brand, Apple is the first technology company to have a shot at multi-generational success. Apple did not start as a luxury brand. It was the best house in a shitty neighborhood, tech hardware, a world of cables, geekware, acronyms, and low margins. In the early days, Apple simply made a more intuitive computer than its competitors. Steve Jobs's notions about elegant packaging only appealed to a minority of customers. It was Steve Wozniak's architecture that drew the rest. Back then, the company appealed largely to consumers' brains. Many early Apple lovers were geeks, which did nothing for its sex appeal. Apple, to its credit, gazed across the tracks at Luxury Town and thought, why not? Why can't we be the best house in the best neighborhood? In the 1980s, the company declined. Machines running Microsoft Windows with Intel chips were faster and cheaper and began to win over the rational organ. The brain. Word and Excel became global standards. You could play most games on the Intel computers, not Apple's. This was when Apple began its move down the torso, from the brain to to the heart and genitals, and just in time. The company was destined to sink below 10% market share from over 90%. The Apple Macintosh computer, launched in 1984, had attractive icons and a personalized look that appealed to the heart. A computer, it turned out, could be friendly. It talked. At its introduction, the computer famously wrote, "Hello," on its screen. Artists could express themselves on the Mac, create beauty, and change the world. Then the big breakthrough, desktop publishing. Adobe software was uniquely suited to the Mac's precise, bitmapped display. Owning an Apple, as embodied in the infamous 1984 commercial, reinforced our belief that Apple users were not another brick in the wall. The result was that I and the employees of my startups struggled through two decades of underpowered and overpriced products just so we could claim we were thinking differently. But it wasn't sexy. Most people back then didn't go anywhere with their computers. They put them in computer rooms, and dragging a potential mate in there to show off some hardware wasn't practical or romantic. To become a true luxury item, the computer would need to shrink, learn new tricks, be more beautiful, and be in, near, or on your person to signal success to peers in public and private. The transformation began with the iPod, a glossy white block the size of a deck of cards that placed an entire music library in your pocket. Among other MP3 players, all of them awkward, gray, navy, and black, the iPod was also a technological miracle. 5 gigabytes of memory versus the second largest competitor, Toshiba's 128 megabytes. Apple searched the electronics industry to find a company willing to make a disk drive so tiny, almost jewel-like. Eventually, Apple would drop computer from its corporate name in recognition that the concept of the computer was anchored in the past. The future would be about stuff, from music to phones powered by computers. The customer could carry these branded products around, even wear them. Apple began its march toward luxury. The 2015 debut of the Apple Watch closed the loop. Its introduction featured on stage a supermodel, Christy Turlington Burns. The cameras panned the audience for gratuitous cameos of famous people. And where did the company buy a 17-page spread to celebrate the new arrival? Not in Computer World or even Time Magazine, as they once had with the Macintosh. No, it was in Vogue. And it featured Peter Belanger photos of the rose gold version, which sells for $12,000. The transformation was complete. Apple had become the best house in the best neighborhood. Scarcity. A kind of meta-scarcity is key to Apple's success. It may sell millions of iPods, iPhones, iWatches, and Apple Watches, but likely only 1% of the world can rationally afford them. And that's how Apple wants it. In the first quarter of 2015, the iPhone accounted for only 18.3% of the smartphones shipped globally, but 92% of the industry's profits. That's luxury marketing. How do you elegantly communicate to friends and strangers that your skills, DNA, and background put you in the 1%, no matter where you are? Easy, carry an iPhone. Plot a heat map of mobile operating systems, and the geography of wealth illuminates. Go to Manhattan. It's all Apple iOS. Head to New Jersey or out to the Bronx, where the average household income plummets, and it's Android. In L.A., if you live in Malibu, Beverly Hills, the Palisades, you have an iPhone. South Central, Oxnard, and Inland Empire, and you own an Android. The iPhone is the clearest signal that you are closer to perfection and have more opportunities to mate. More writers have written more good articles on Apple than any other company, yet most fail to see it as a luxury brand. I've been advising luxury brands for 25 years and believe these firms, from Porsche to Prada, share 5 key attributes: an iconic founder, artisanship, vertical integration, global reach, and a premium price. Let's dig into each of these more deeply. 1. An iconic founder. Nothing builds a self-expressive benefit brand more effectively than the constant personification of the brand in the form of one person, especially the founder. CEOs come and go, but founders are forever. As a poor teen in the 1830s, Louis Vuitton walked 300 miles to Paris, barefoot. He established himself as an expert box maker, and before long was crafting exquisite trunks for the Empress of France and wife of Napoleon III, Eugénie de Montijo. Vuitton was the prototype for the iconic founder. These entrepreneurs have life stories with compelling ups and downs, along with a skill set that is more commonly found in museums than in stores. Art, and the democratization of art, artisanship, fuels and sustains their brands. These founders usually rise from the artisan class. They are blessed or cursed with knowing early what they must do with their lives. Make beautiful things. They have no choice. It's easy to be cynical about bling and the frivolity of the sector. However, drive a Porsche 911, see your cheekbones pop with NARS orgasm blush, or find your gaze more intense, your objective more resolute, because you are the guy wearing Brunello Cucinelli. That's why artisans have created more wealth than any cohort in modern history. Some people think luxury is the opposite of poverty. It is not. It is the opposite of vulgarity, said Coco Chanel. To grasp the power of Steve Jobs as the icon for innovation, think young Elvis. If he had died in his 20s after the Sun studio sessions and before he left for the army, we never would have seen him waddling across Las Vegas stages in white bangled bell-bottoms. Elvis exited before he hit 40. If he had hung around a few decades longer, he'd be doing oldies acts on retirement cruises, and Graceland would be a mobile home park. Dying removes the icon from the inevitable judgment of everyday existence, including aging, and elevates persona to legend. Ideal for a brand. Imagine what the Tiger Woods brand would be worth to Nike if, instead of fading into mediocrity, the once iconic golf star had been run over by his wife that night she discovered he couldn't keep his putter in his bag. That's arguably one of the few upsides to a public figure passing away. It inoculates them from foolish acts that destroy their reputation and, worse, aging. We know that the founding fathers of this country were quietly relieved when George Washington shuffled off this mortal coil, because he was then past the risk of tarnishing his sterling reputation. It doesn't matter if the iconic founder was a jerk in real life. Apple proves this. The world has created a Jesus-like hero worship of Steve Jobs. In reality, it appears that Steve Jobs was not a good person and a flawed father. He sat in court and denied his own blood, refusing to pay child support to a daughter he knew was biologically his, even though by then he was worth several $100 million. And, as already noted, he also appears to have perjured himself to government investigators regarding the stock option program at Apple. Yet when Jobs died in 2011, the world mourned, with thousands posting shrines on the internet, at Apple headquarters, and company stores around the world, and even in front of his old high school. This marked the deification of the iconic founder, moving from stardom to sainthood, a shift made even easier by Jobs's increasingly ascetic look in his final years. Since then, Apple's brand has burned brighter. There are few better examples of what Pope Francis refers to as an unhealthy idolatry of money than our obsession with Steve Jobs. It is conventional wisdom that Steve Jobs put a dent in the universe. No, he didn't. Steve Jobs, in my view, spat on the universe. People who get up every morning, get their kids dressed, get them to school, and have an irrational passion for their kids' well-being dent the universe. The world needs more homes with engaged parents, not a better fucking phone. 2. Artisanship. Success in luxury comes from minute attention to detail and expert, almost superhuman craftsmanship. When it works, it seems as if an alien has arrived from a distant planet to make better sunglasses or silk scarves. Bargain shoppers may wonder why anyone would take so much trouble to design hinges that fold inward, or to knot every tiny thread on the part of a hat that you can't even see. But for people who have discretionary income and aren't worried about survival, the experience of living with a great work of craftsmanship is irreplaceable. Apple's language of luxury is simplicity, the ultimate sophistication. From the snow-white design style in the 80s, off-white surfaces, horizontal lines to make computers look smaller, to the iPod 1,000 songs in your pocket, simplicity is an obsession at Apple. Simplicity entails sleek appearance and ease of use. When the interaction with an object sparks delight, brand loyalty increases. The iPod click wheel was at once elegant and playful. The iPhone introduced touchscreens. You had me at scrolling. Apple chose aluminum for the PowerBook casings, as it was lighter than most materials and allowed for a thinner body and better heat conductivity. And it looks premium and exclusive. As an old iMac ad put it, Apple technology is simply amazing and amazingly simple. It's how Apple makes products that repeatedly become icons. Objects that appear effortless, so simple, coherent, and inevitable that there could be no rational alternative. Cognitive psychology shows that attractive objects make us feel good, which in turn makes us more resilient in creative challenges. Attractive things work better, says Don Norman, Vice President of Advanced Technology at Apple from 1993 to 1998. When you wash and wax a car, it drives better, doesn't it? Or at least it feels like it does. 3. Vertical integration. In the early 1980s, The Gap was a chain of pedestrian clothing stores stocked with records, as well as Levi's and other casual clothes, some mixed in with The Gap's own brand. Then, in 1983, the new CEO, Mickey Drexler, remade the company. He softened the lights, bleached the wood, piped in music, expanded the dressing rooms, and decorated the walls with large black-and-white photographs by famous photographers. Each store gave the customer a place to experience the brand Drexler envisioned. He wasn't selling luxury, but creating a world around the brand and engaging the consumer face-to-face. He was taking a page from luxury brands and creating a simulacrum of that luxury. His strategy stoked revenue and profits, and The Gap began a 20-year run that was the envy of the retail sector. Many point to Drexler as the merchant prince. However, his impact on business was greater than that. Drexler recognized that while television could broadcast a brand's message, physical stores could go much further. They gave customers a place to step into the brand, to smell it and touch it. The store, Drexler decided, is where he would build brand equity. So while Gap's key rival, Levi's, continued to create the best TV commercials, Drexler built the best stores. The result? From 1997 to 2005, The Gap more than tripled in revenue, from $6.5 billion to $16 billion. While Levi Strauss & Company sank from $6.9 billion to $4.1 billion. Brand building moved from the airwaves to the physical world, and Levi's got caught flat-footed. I believe the world would be a better place had LS & Company registered Apple-like success, as the Haas family, who own LS & Company, is what you hope all business owners would be. Modest, committed to the community, and generous. Steve Jobs brought Drexler onto Apple's board of directors in 1999, soon after his return to Apple, and 2 years later, Apple launched its first brick-and-mortar store in Tysons Corner, Virginia. Apple stores were glitzier than Gap stores. Most experts yawned. Brick-and-mortar, they said, was the past. The internet was the future. as if Steve Jobs, of all people, didn't understand that. It's difficult to remember now, but when Apple made that move back then, most people figured the company was wrong, that Apple was a company lurching toward irrelevance, and that by opening fancy stores, it was positioning itself for luxury with the equivalent of a walker. How dumb was that, they thought. Couldn't Apple see that the tech market now revolved around commodity boxes powered by Microsoft and Intel? That the boom was in e-commerce? The company's former chief financial officer, Joseph Graziano, signaled disaster, telling Business Week that Jobs was insisting on serving caviar in a world that seems content with cheese and crackers. The stores, of course, changed the tech industry and advanced Apple as a luxury company. The iPhone drove Apple's share, but stores drove the brand and margin. Walk up Fifth Avenue or the Champs-Élysées, and you see Vuitton, Cartier, Hermès, and Apple. These are captive channels. A $26,000 Cartier Ballon Bleu watch or a $5,000 suede Burberry trench coat would lose their luster on shelves at Macy's. But stores operated by the brands become temples to the brand. Apple's stores sell nearly $5,000 per square foot. Number two is a convenience store, which lags by 50%. It wasn't the iPhone, but the Apple store that defined Apple's success. 4. Global. Rich people are more homogenous than any cohort on Earth. I recently spoke at J.P. Morgan's Alternative Investment Summit. Its CEO, Jamie Dimon, hosts the bank's 300 most important, crazy rich, private bank clients and the 50 or so CEOs and founders of the funds into which they invest for their private bank clients. 400 masters of the universe, plus people whom the universe has smiled upon. The Lucky Sperm Club. People from nearly every country and culture. And yet a sea of sameness. Everyone in the room speaks the same language, literally and figuratively. Wears Hermès, Cartier, or Rolex, has kids at Ivy League schools, and vacations in a coastal town of Italy or France or St. Bart's. Fill a room with middle-class people from around the world, and you have diversity. They eat different food, wear different clothes, and can't understand each other's languages. It's anthropology on parade. The global elite, by contrast, is a rainbow of the same damn color. That's why it's easier for luxury brands to permeate geographic boundaries than mass-market peers. Mass-market retailers, including Walmart and Carrefour, have to hire ethnographers to guide them in local markets. But luxury brands, including Apple, define their own universe. Iconic brand consistency is achieved by key design elements. Glass, a glass pane, a cube, or cylinder as an entry, often a clear glass staircase, patented by Jobs. Open space, minimal interiors, no inventory in store. Products are brought out to purchase. The 492 stores dropped into exclusive shopping districts in 18 countries draw more than 1 million worshippers every day. The Magic Kingdom only drew 20.5 million people total in 2015. Apple also runs a global supply chain. The components stream in from Chinese mines, Japanese studios, and American chip fabs to contractors' immense manufacturing plants and settlements in multiple nations, notably and notoriously China. And then on to Apple stores, both brick and mortar and online. Meanwhile, the billions in earnings from the sale of these products follow their own circuitous routes back to a network of tax havens, including Ireland. The result is a gargantuan profit and luxury margins at the scale of a low-cost producer. Apple is one of the most profitable firms in history, but it doesn't need to endure the nuisance of U.S. tax rates. 5. Price premium. High prices signal quality and exclusivity. Survey your own browsing. Aren't you drawn to and compelled by the more expensive item? Even on eBay, don't you search by highest price out of curiosity? negative economic elasticity holds. If Hermès marketed a scarf for $19.95, most existing customers would lose interest. Apple, in this sense, is not Hermès. It can't sell computers or phones for 20 or 100 times the price of a commodity brand. But it does charge a hefty premium. An iPhone 7 without a subscription subsidy costs $749. A blue R1 Plus is $159. And the latest from BlackBerry, BlackBerry Key 1, is $549. In this, and in most everything else, except decent HR policies, Steve Jobs learned from Hewlett-Packard, the pioneering quality tech product pricing. From the first days of Apple Computer, Jobs had publicly stated his admiration of that company and his desire to create Apple in its image. One of HP's attributes that Jobs most admired was its commitment to making the best, that is, most innovative and highest quality, products, particularly calculators, and then charging the shit out of engineers desperate to buy them. The difference was that HP was largely a professional equipment supplier, hardly a luxury product business, while Apple sold directly to consumers, and thus could take full advantage of all the signals and signifiers of elegance. Some Apple customers aren't thrilled to learn that their purchases are based on irrational decisions. They think they're smart and sophisticated. So they rationalize that their brain rode shotgun on the decision. It's just a better phone, they say. The software has an intuitive user interface. And look at all of those cool productivity apps. The laptops work better. The watch encourages me to walk an extra 3,000 steps a day. The higher price is fully justified, they tell themselves. This may all be true, and people cite similar reasoning when they pay rich premiums for Mercedes or Bentley. Luxury products have to be great, but they also signal status. They improve your procreational brand. This may not be apparent in rich neighborhoods where it seems that almost everyone carries various Apple gadgets. How cool can you possibly be as the 14th person to open a MacBook in Paris's Café de Flore? In these cases, try looking at it the other way. If Apple's the standard, how much does a person's attractiveness to the opposite sex suffer when he or she boots up a Dell or pulls out a Moto X to snap a picture? I'm not saying, by the way, that the sexual bounce coming from a luxury purchase will actually occur. Millions of iPhone owners sleep alone at night. But buying the luxury item triggers an emotion, a boost in serotonin that attends happiness and success. And maybe it does make you more attractive to strangers. Certainly Adele won't. The decision to pay a premium comes from an ancient and primal urge from the lower body, even while the brain yammers on about the rational stuff. I'll explore this phenomenon further in Chapter 7. There will be a lot of big losers on the other side of Apple's luxury coin. For example, 2015 was arguably Nike's best year. The firm increased its revenues by $2.8 billion. By comparison, Apple grew its revenues $51 billion. That's an Atlantic Ocean of discretionary dollars people won't be spending on other things. The most likely to tank under the Apple onslaught are the mid-level luxury companies, the ones selling stuff for less than $1,000, J. Crew, Michael Kors, Swatch, and others. Their customers count their money, and young consumers care more about their phones and coffee than clothes. So where do limited discretionary dollars go? An old phone with a cracked spiderweb screen limits their options for mating far more than last year's jacket or purse. They might scrimp on the $78 patterned Headley hoodie at Abercrombie & Fitch, the $298 quilted leather shoulder bag at Michael Kors, or the Kate Spade Luna Drive Willow satchel, which goes for $498. On the other hand, that $51 billion lost to Apple shouldn't affect platinum brands, such as Porsche or Brunello Cucinelli. Their customers can afford everything, and don't have to choose. Steve Jobs' decision to transition from a tech, to a luxury brand, is one of the most consequential and value-creating insights in business history. Technology firms can scale, but they are rarely timeless. On the other hand, Chanel will outlive Cisco, and Gucci will witness the meteor that sets Google on a path to extinction. Of the four horsemen, Apple has by far the best genetics, and I believe the greatest chance of seeing the 22nd century. Keep in mind, Apple is the only firm among the four horsemen, at least for now, that has thrived post the original founder and management team. Tech's good-looking corpse. The research of NYU Stern's professor of finance, Aswath Damodaran, highlights that technology firms experience the traditional company lifecycle at an increased speed. They age in dog years, if you will. The good news is that these tech companies can launch a product, scale the firm, and acquire customers faster than other industries, which face annoyances like real estate, capital requirements, or distribution channels that might require years and a huge labor force to create. The bad news? The same rocket fuel that sends a tech firm to the moon also is available to a bevy of younger, smarter, faster competitors coming up fast behind them. Male lions have a life expectancy of 10 to 14 years in the wild. However, they live 20 years or more in captivity. Why? Because in captivity, they aren't constantly challenged by other males. Males in the wild usually die of injuries from fights protecting or challenging the throne. Very few die of old age. Tech companies are like alpha male lions in the wild. It's good to be king. A higher multiple on earnings, rapid wealth, when it works, and the love and admiration of a society that sees its innovators as rock stars. However, everyone wants to be king. All it takes is strength, speed, violent aggression, and being too stupid to know you will fail to dethrone the king. Apple not only transitioned from one of the greatest visionaries to one of the greatest operators, it has been able to extend its life by transitioning to a luxury brand. How? Apple recognized that the CEO after Steve Jobs needed to be an operator who understood how to scale the firm. If Apple's board had wanted a visionary, it would have made Johnny Ive CEO. Visionless. I'd argue Apple lacks a vision. However, it still thrives, as making the iPhone bigger and then smaller again is genius in its simplicity. Let's take the best bread in the world and slice it a bunch of ways. The firm also has bought more time, as it's realized it has the brand and assets to make expensive, both capital and time, investments in becoming a luxury brand that other tech firms cannot. As early as the Macintosh, Apple realized it wanted off the tech train, and moved away from the ethos of offering more each year for less money, Moore's Law. Apple's business today is to sell to people goods, services, and emotions, being closer to God and being more attractive. Apple delivers those factors via semiconductor and display technology, powers them with electricity, and wraps them in luxury. It's a potent and intoxicating blend that has created the most profitable company in history. You used to be what you wore, and some now believe you are what you eat. But who you really are has become what you text on. The Builder King. You would be amazed at how many people still believe, against all evidence, that Steve Jobs actually invented all of Apple's great products, as if he sat at a lab table in the R&D department at Apple headquarters in Cupertino and soldered chips on a tiny motherboard. Until, boom, he gave the world the iPod. Actually, that was Steve Wozniak with the Apple I a quarter century before. Steve Jobs was a genius, but his gifts lay elsewhere. And nowhere was that genius more visible than when business experts everywhere were proclaiming the disintermediation of tech, the disappearance of the physical distribution and retail channels as they were replaced by the virtualization of e-commerce. Jobs understood, as none of his peers did, that whereas content, even commodity products, might be sold online, if you wanted to sell electronics hardware as premium-priced luxury items, you had to sell them like other luxury items. That is, in shining temples under brilliant lights, with ardent young genius salespeople at your beck and call. Most of all, you had to sell those items in glass boxes where customers could be seen by others. Not just other customers, but passers-by, who could peer in and see you among the select. And once you had accomplished that, you could sell almost anything in that store, as long as it was elegant, stylishly boxed, and shared the common design tropes with its more expensive peers. It is why Apple commands margins that no tech company has ever enjoyed, having scaled impossible heights, the premium-priced product and the low-cost producer. Nothing comes close in other luxury categories. In handbags, Bottega Veneta, a premium-priced handbag, is a high-cost producer. In automobiles, the premium-priced product, Ferrari, is anything but low-cost producer. In hotels, the premium-priced product, Mandarin Oriental, is far from the low-cost producer. Yet Apple manages to be both. And it does so because it emphasized manufacturing and robotics a generation before most tech, especially consumer tech, companies, established a world-class supply chain, and then established a retail presence, backed by a small army of support and IT experts, that has become the envy of every brand and retailer. Chutes, ladders, and moats. Firms tried to build higher and higher walls to keep enemies, upstarts and competitors, from invasion. Business theorists call these structures barriers to entry. They are nice in theory, but increasingly, traditional walls are showing cracks, even crumbling, especially in tech. The plummeting price of processing power, Moore's Law again, coupled with an increase in bandwidth, and a new generation of leadership that has digital in their DNA, has produced bigger ladders than anyone ever expected. ESPN, J. Crew, and Jeb Bush, all unassailable, no? No. Digital ladders, over-the-top video, fast fashion, and at-real Donald Trump, can vault almost any wall. So, what's a ridiculously successful firm to do? Malcolm Gladwell, the Jesus of business books, highlights the parable of David and Goliath to make the key point. Don't fight on other people's terms. In other words, once you've made the jump to light speed as a tech firm, you need to immunize yourself from the same conquering weapons your army levied on the befuddled prey. There are several obvious examples. Network effects. Everyone is on Facebook because everyone's on Facebook. IP protection. Every firm in tech over $10 billion is suing and being sued by every other $10 billion tech firm. And developing an industry standard, monopoly, ecosystem. Typing this on Word because I have no choice. However, I'd argue that digging deeper moats is the real key to long-term success. The iPhone will not be the best phone for long. Too many firms are struggling to catch up. However, Apple has a key asset with a stronger immune system. It's 492 retail stores in 19 countries. Wait, a marauder could just put up an online store, no? No. HP.com versus the Apple Regent Street store in London is like bringing a butter knife to a gunfight. And even if Samsung decides to allocate the capital, 9 women can't have a baby in a month, and the Korean giant would need a decade at least to present a similar offering. Brick and mortar's troubles have been laid at the feet of digital disruption. There is some truth to that. However, digital sales are still only 10 to 12% of retail. It's not stores that are dying, but the middle class and the stores serving them. Most that are located in or serving middle-class households are struggling. By comparison, stores in affluent neighborhoods are holding strong. The middle class used to be 61% of Americans. Now they are the minority, representing less than half the population. The rest being lower or upper income. So Apple, recognizing that ladders will keep getting taller, opted for more analog, time and capital expensive, moats. Google and Samsung are both coming for Apple. But they are more likely to produce a better phone than to replicate the romance, connection, and general awesomeness of Apple's stores. So every successful firm in the digital age needs to ask, in addition to big, tall walls, where can I build deep moats? That is, old economy barriers that are expensive and take a long time to dredge and for competitors to cross. Apple has done this superbly, continually investing in the world's best brand and in stores. Amazon, also going for moats, is building 100+ expensive and slow-to-get-built warehouses. How old economy? A good bet is Amazon will open thousands before they are done. Recently, Amazon announced leases on 20 767s and purchased thousands of Amazon-branded tractor trailers. Google has server farms and is launching early 20th century aviation technology, blimps, into the atmosphere that will beam broadband down to Earth. Facebook, among the four horsemen, has the fewest old economy moats, making it the most vulnerable to an invading army with big-ass ladders. You can expect that to change, as Facebook announced they, along with Microsoft, are laying cable across the floor of the Atlantic. The success of single companies like Apple can hollow out entire markets, even regions. The iPhone debuted in 2007 and devastated Motorola and Nokia. Together, they have shed 100,000 jobs. Nokia, at its peak, represented 30% of Finland's GDP and paid almost a quarter of all of that country's corporate taxes. Russia may have rolled tanks into Finland in 1939, but Apple's 2007 commercial invasion